You're listening to the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 145 for the week of October 19th, 2011.
Welcome back to the Experience Points Podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
My name is George Albor.
We're the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a website dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture. And this week, George, we are reaching back into the archives.
We are. This week's topic actually comes from a listener, Chris Rickard? Rickard, perhaps?
Hopefully we got your name right, Chris. If not, just, you know, feel free to correct us because you're a loyal listener and we do everything you say, clearly.
That's exactly right. So this week, Scott, what are we talking about exactly?
We are talking about the first half of the Team Eco re-release collection that they just put out on PS3. They remastered Blue Point, which, as an interesting side note, same company that did the HD remasters of the first God of War, God of War 1 and 2, rather, for the PlayStation 3. Helped Sony and Team Eco do the an HD remaster of Eco and Shadow of the Colossus. And so we're going to talk about Eco this week and then work our way through Shadow of the Colossus and the coming weeks do another podcast about that.
Yeah, and then I think we'll probably end up saving some of the special features things for the Shadow of the Colossus week.
Yeah.
Just because there's actually a lot more to the content of the whole package than just the games themselves. But I think it's interesting to visit something that is considered a classic, right? Like, this is one of the games that people laud as one of the best games ever made.
Yep, and a modern classic, too. You know, this isn't like we're revisiting Pac-Man or something. Like, this is within basically the last 10 years, so it's like a fairly new entry into the canon, all things considered.
So, when did Eco come out?
The original version was 2001. And that was on the PS2.
Interesting. Did you play it when it first came out?
I did not play it when it first came out. I played it around the Shadow of the Colossus release date, which I think was like 2004, 2005. I'll have to check in the future. But I mean, it was several years at least after Eco was released that I played it. How about yourself?
Yeah, it's similar. I don't think I played it, you know, on release. In fact, I'm pretty sure not a lot of people did play it on release.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I took a look at, you know, Wikipedia and various other sources, and it wasn't, you know, it was definitely well received, but it didn't break down the doors as far as selling a bunch of copies, and so it's nice to see it get a second life here.
Yeah, so what were your first impressions of the game when you first played it?
Let's see, thinking back in the mists of time, you know, one of the things that always stood out to me, even back when I first played it, was kind of the sparse atmosphere of it.
Yeah.
And sparse in terms of the HUD, or just the lack thereof, there is no HUD, and the environment. It was one of the first games that I remember thinking that the type of lighting that they were using was both a technical and an artistic consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Like, remember, like the washed out colors and the like heavy bloom, like everything was like oversaturated.
Yeah, and you would come out sometimes like off of a window ledge and just kind of be blinded for a second.
Yeah, and it was a unique experience because it's even back then, you know, lighting was still kind of coming into its own, and there was a lot of technical hurdles to overcome, obviously. But there's also in a game where it's not really giving you much information, that the way that they used lighting and scenery conveyed the story, and it was, you know, I didn't think about games, I wasn't as serious about video games back then in terms of analyzing them as I am now, so it was kind of a formative experience to think about how that environment was telling the story.
Yeah, same here, absolutely. And I like that you mentioned lighting, because, you know, lighting has come a long way. There are a lot of games now that I think use their lighting better than Eco does.
And abuse their lighting, too.
That's also true. But I still think that the lighting in Eco is very unique. I mean, the sort of washed out thing, I don't know if that would fly anymore. I think people would probably critique it for being, you know, overly bright on occasion and not subtle enough in its use of lighting.
And how much do we make fun of games these days for overusing lens flare? You know, like, yeah, everything has lens flare on it, yeah, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, my first impressions were something similar. And, you know, I remember from the moment I started playing the game, I absolutely loved it. And even now, it ranks probably in my top 10 quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's weird because I feel like there are aspects of the game that don't age particularly well. And part of it, you know, like lighting, for example, I think is... It's weird because there's both... Everything that is in the game that doesn't age particularly well, because we have better examples of it now in modern titles, still feels really unique in Eco, you know? And it, to some extent, playing it again now feels like playing a sort of historical artifact that is incredibly important in that even if it didn't have a great effect on the landscape, marked one of, at least, like you said, one of my first personal changes in terms of how I view the potential of games.
So with that being said, where should we start? I mean, should we talk about our responses to the story, or should we talk about what has evolved and what ages well, or you know, what is the best way to analyze something like a re-release?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard because, you know, to some extent you want to say, well, we want to judge the title as independent of the sort of history that it comes with,
mm-hmm,
right? I think that there's a legitimate reason to do something like that. At the same time, anyone who's never played Eco should definitely pick this up,
mm-hmm,
but it's almost more to have a sort of piece of history on your shelf than it is to... I mean, well, I think if you haven't played the game, you absolutely should.
Yeah, yeah. But if you have, it's still a good touchstone to be aware of and to refamiliarize yourself with.
Right, right.
Well, maybe we should talk about it just right now, you know, set aside its historical context for a second, and let's go back into it and like the feel of it. Like I hadn't played it for years, literally. Mm-hmm. And so once I got in, just, you know, straight up, like, mechanically as a game, I had forgotten how loose it was, how moving around felt in Eco. Like, it's way less precise than many subsequent games that I've played.
Right, absolutely. I mean, the animations and the body of Eco sort of flail around in everything you do.
Yeah.
You know, when you go up to an edge and you stop abruptly, he sort of swings his arm around, and there's, you know, there's quite a few times in which it's like you're almost going to fall off a ledge, mm-hmm, or do fall off a ledge.
And it's not the same type of animation that you see in something like Uncharted, even though it's similar. It's more, mm-hmm, like you were saying, it's more flailing. Like, it's loosey-goosey. Like, you're never quite 100% confident as to how close you can get until you can stop, or how fast you're going to sprint out of a certain situation. You know, there's a lot of... I forgot how scrambly the game was. You know, you're always scrambling to get somewhere.
One of the first articles I wrote for Experience Points, like 3 years ago or whatever, was about Eco and Shadow of the Colossus and the way they sort of model fragility, mm-hmm, and vulnerability.
Yeah.
And I think that scrambling animation works really well in that regard, you know, because it does feel like I'm a little boy that's sort of not completely fully aware of maybe even his own strength or his own mobility.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the other thing that surprised me when I went back into it is I played it with the default control settings, and... This was before what I like to call, like, basically the Americanization of the medium happened.
Right.
And like, the jump button is triangle. What?
Yeah. 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 And it's sometimes it's terrible because you'll jump and accidentally hit a button you don't mean to push.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, that was a different time when things just weren't as rigid. Like, the games just varied wildly based on, you know, what basic actions would be assigned to what buttons.
Yeah.
And it was just, it took a little bit of time to think about it, to just think about it. Like, I haven't had to think about what button to use to jump for many years now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of games don't even have jump anymore, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, but it does make sense, right? Like, the circle button is used to attack enemies.
Or the square button.
Oh, the square button, yeah. That's right. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, never mind then. Maybe it doesn't make sense.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you're looking at it for. I mean, you could look at it as it is the top button on the controller, and therefore the jump is to kind of ascend objects. Mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, it's for a long time, and this is a cultural thing, I was listening to I think it was the 8-4 podcast. They're a studio that does a lot of translation and localization, and they were saying that in Japan a red circle is a culturally accepted sign of correctness or accepting, like a right answer would be denoted by a red circle,
as opposed to meaning stop over here, right?
Yeah, exactly. And like for in the West and in America in particular, to mark something in a checkbox with an X means like, yes, affirmative, I am checking this. And in Japan, right, a blue X a lot of times means incorrect or, you know, something like that. And so you go back, especially into the PS1 and PS2 days, and a lot of the games, and especially I'm thinking of the Square Enix games now, all the old Final Fantasy games, the A button on the Super Nintendo and the circle button on the PlayStation would be accepting things.
Interesting.
And so it makes more sense that in Eco, pressing the circle button is basically your use button. Like if you want to pull a lever or something, like you use the circle button because that is your affirmative button, you know, in a cultural context.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd never thought about that.
It's weird, and it's something that we've kind of grown away from as the industry has changed and as geography has, you know, started to as where our games come from culturally and geographically have changed, the buttons layouts start changing too.
Yeah. Another thing that stood out for me, and maybe I should first say that I've played this game like 4 times before now. Mm-hmm. So I'm already really familiar with it. And, you know, I think the last time I played it was only a couple years back. It's not, you know, it's not something that feels completely new to me. It feels more like I'm just stepping into sort of a comfortable skin again.
Yeah.
But one of the things that caught my eye, that maybe caught my eye specifically because I've been playing, you know, so many other games lately, is that the camera in the game cares so little about the characters themselves.
Yeah.
A lot of times the positioning of the camera is such that it just gives you an interesting view.
Mm-hmm.
And there are moments when, you know, maybe you'll be running along a ledge or especially when Yorda is sort of taking her damn time to get up a ladder.
Yeah.
You'll be waiting and you'll pan to the left or you'll pan to the right. Or even when you hold down the Yorda call button and she's far away and it pans to her.
Mm-hmm.
It generally takes a sort of slow pace to show you the scenery.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like so much of the camera positioning is just built on, we want to show you the world that you're in and not focus on what you as a character are doing, because you're not doing all that much.
Yeah.
You know, like most of the time you're not fighting.
You're running, you're jumping,
Yeah, and you don't need a crazy amount of angles. You don't need an over-the-shoulder action button, you know? So the entire thing feels sort of more significant in terms of how it looks at the castle and the space that you're in, which is something I just don't feel like I've seen very often.
Well, what you said about the camera as if it was an entity, like it doesn't care about you, you know, like as if it had an interest, like really strikes home with me, because the way that the camera frames every scene is to frame the environment just as much as it is to frame the player.
Yeah.
And so it really reminds me of what, you know, like a weird version of Valve's AI director in Left 4 Dead. Like there seems to be some entity that is also working alongside of you while you're traversing the world. Like there's an actual unknown director that's shooting it, you know?
But it comes off as relating to me as the player, not as me as Eco,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it's, even when it's showing me the environment, it's not necessarily showing me the environment so that I'm familiar with it and therefore can overcome the obstacle that's coming next.
Mm-hmm.
Although that's there as well, of course. You know, sometimes the lighting is such that it'll show an open window that you'll have to climb into later, for example.
Well, especially when you go into a new room, and at first, there's a lot of times where I'll climb to a ledge or go into a new room and I'll be like, man, this camera angle's terrible. But then I notice that the camera is slowly shifting. It's just mm-hmm. not doing it instantly. Like there's real cinematography in the game,
right?
And it's not the camera just doesn't snap to your beck and call. You have to kind of follow along with its scripted cinematography, which is something that does not happen very often in most games that are mainly focused on making sure the player has control at all times.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's almost like in most games, playing with the camera is something that's done during cutscenes.
Mm-hmm.
And then while you're playing, you control the camera in a very close-up way to give you the ability to examine things as much as you want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, But even in, you know, even in Ico, you could zoom in and you can move the camera around, but it's not particularly responsive.
Right, and you can only, like, pan a little bit to the left and right in some scenes. Like, and again, you lose all sense of direction because it's not like time stops. If you make yourself as the player, if you make Ico out of frame, action is still happening. You're just not looking at it.
Well, and that's the great thing. Like, there are the two segments that take place on the outside, like the outside towers that you have to activate to open the doors. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's played Ico recently knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Because, you know the sense of space after you play it once. And after you play it four times, you could probably draw a map of it.
Yeah.
But on those upper ledges, the distance is so far on occasion when you're running that you can move the camera around and take a look at the environment while still moving Ico and Yorda, knowing, okay, I'm on my path, but I'm going to take this time to sort of admire the scenery.
Yep.
And I think it feels apparent that the game knows that you're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, we've made a beautiful world for you, and now you have a chance to take a look at it and without feeling like you are wasting your time.
Branching off from what you just brought up, taking the time to look at the environment and realizing the scale of everything is something that I remember and that still comes home when I replay it all these years later. It was one of the earlier games where I started being impressed with how large a scale worlds are being created.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's I don't know, it's there's something about, especially the, and even some of the interior scenes, like there's this idea that this world is huge and it's just dwarfing you. It's not segments of levels, it's an entire castle that actually exists in an architectural sense.
Yeah. There's a great one room in particular that I think is really interesting. There is there's the main door on the very bottom level that leads to the gate to the entire castle. Mm-hmm. And the bridge.
Yeah, the bridge, yeah.
But in that room, there's three tiers, and you go to each tier.
Mm-hmm.
And the camera is ever only situated on slightly above where you're located. So every time you enter the room, after progressing a little bit farther, you're looking at that room from a higher vantage point and then another higher vantage point. So near the end of the game, you're looking down upon this room that you've been in and passed through for the past maybe 45 minutes,
mm-hmm.
right? But you're seeing it at such a high scale that it sort of reminds you that everything you've been doing is all interconnected in this sort of large scale environment.
It's such an elegant way to communicate what, like in a Super Mario game, would just be a linear list of levels. Like, mm-hmm. look at all of your progress. You did World 1-1 and World 1-2 and World 1-3. And in Ico, it shows it just through the environment.
Right.
Like, here's all the levels that you did. Look at them. They exist as architecture.
Yeah, and you can look out of a window and see where you were just at. Or that the example I just mentioned, every time you go through that segment, you lower a drawbridge, right?
Yeah.
And so by the time you're on the third tier, you see all of the drawbridges lowered already because you've done that,
mm-hmm.
you know? It reminds you that your actions on this world, even though minuscule, have serious impact.
Yeah, it was very impressive at the time, and I'm glad to realize that it holds up, you know, not many games do that. There's not a good sense of place in many modern games and in many historical games too. Like it's a rare thing to have something that well thought out.
Yeah. The other thing that struck me as I played the game again was how quiet it is.
Yep.
And you know, a lot of the times when we think about how sound creates senses of space, I usually imagine horror games because they rely on a sort of, you know, distant drips or gushy sounds.
Creepy
noises in the background that ricochet off of the walls to give you a sense of space, right? Creates that sense of horror. And this game it's not to create horror, but it is to create space. It is to create that environment, you know? Like when you step outside and you hear seagulls in the distance and you can see small birds in the distance, mm-hmm. you know? That creates space better than I think an orchestral score could have done at that same time.
And sometimes you'll get to the outer areas of the castle and you'll hear the coastal breeze. You know, the wind will pick up much more heavily than when you're in an interior courtyard.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many, and overall, there's just so many little details in the game that create its environment. You know, the doves and the pigeons that kind of flitter around the courtyards, and Yorda chases them if you're not really doing anything.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a nice thing about the HD remastered version. I started, you know, recognizing or possibly even re-recognizing little details like the gates that block your progression that Yorda has to open with her powers have crouched statues of little boys with horns on them.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I remember it blew my mind back then, and it blew my mind this time when I realized it again. The shadow characters that you fight, some of them have horns.
You're right.
And so it's like, oh my gosh, you know, these are the ghosts basically of the other sacrifices that happened over the years.
Yeah. And I think that's a good segue into the story elements of it. But one of the things that always fascinated me about this game and Shadow of the Colossus to an equal extent was the way that, like you said, you are a small character in such a large world, and that metaphor carries over into the story, in which you're shown a small segment of what is potentially a very expansive legend, mm-hmm. you know, that you're playing a part of.
And they don't talk down to the player. They don't baby the player. Like, there's no exposition dumps. Like, okay, I'm going to talk for half an hour about the mythology of this world. Like, you get it all organically, and you have to connect the dots throughout the game. And it's just it just shows a lot of confidence in the player that they didn't feel the need, or they didn't want to take the time to, you know, painstakingly spell everything out.
Yeah.
Did the story hold, just narratively, did the story hold up again now that you've played it through for another time?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the interesting things that comes up now, though, is, you know, having experienced so many iterations on you're the hero and you need to save the princess, mm-hmm. there is a moment of it rubbing me the wrong way that Yorda is so sort of passive and defenseless in everything that's going on. I don't blame the game or anything. It's more sort of like indicative of a problem in the industry as a whole.
And the problem in society as a whole.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that being said, like, I do find the story really touching. You know, at the end of the game, and I guess spoilers for Eco, maybe we should have said that earlier.
Yeah.
but at the end of the game, you know, you kill Yorda's mother, ostensibly.
Something, yeah.
Something. And I was playing with my partner, and she said, does Eco, do you save the princess? Do you save Yorda? And as the castle's crumbling around Eco and he's unconscious after this battle, I'm like, no, Yorda saves me.
Yeah.
And it's so awesome to be able to say something like that. And sort of have the ending be, you know, it's not a big heroic ending. Like, the castle's collapsing, but this isn't Nathan Drake who's like running through carnage.
Yeah, right? That's true.
Like, you've put in a lot of effort to get where you are, and then the character is done and you just pass out and you're unconscious.
Yeah.
It's not heroic. In the way that a lot of other stories are. So even though it sort of carries over that save the princess mentality that a lot of other games do as well, I think it still accomplishes something that is far more unique than anything else that tries.
And now that at the very end, when she regains her powers, there's just a very nice poetic moment of her repaying you basically for all of the help that you've given her throughout the entire game. And
right.
her pushing you out of the castle, possibly, you know, it's the ending is somewhat ambiguous, you know, depending on how she feels towards the witch/mother character, and you know, maybe that place was her home, you know, like, it's kind of a melancholy ending, even though it's somewhat happy at the end.
Yeah. You know, I'd never really thought, I mean, again, like I said, I've played this game numerous times, but I've never really thought about what it could mean from the perspective of Ueda, the designer.
Mm.
And I found myself thinking, you know, maybe this is a coming-of-age story. You know, maybe Yorda represents a sister figure, and the mother represents, you know, the designer's actual mother. And
mm-hmm.
I started thinking about family relationships in Japan and ways that maybe this game sort of addresses the pressures that come from familial relationships.
Yeah.
And the expectations of community, you know, like, Eco is a little boy that is kicked out of his community because people are scared, and he encounters basically a fucked up family inside of the castle.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if the game is meant to be very deep and meant to address some of those more adult themes, but I think the fact that it is so quiet in terms of explaining its story, that if you want to read that into the game, you definitely can.
And one of the things that you were saying about how it's you know, the ending isn't necessarily heroic. It ties into the other point you made about the familial relations, because there's really no audience in mm-hmm. the game, you know, in the game narratively. Like, you're not really saving the world. You're taking part in a single conflict that you know, its ramifications aren't really clear on the wider world. So this is like a personal problem externalized. And so, like, you're really doing it to figure out, you know, what the... You're doing it to figure out Ico's story and to figure out Yorda's story. You're not doing it to impress the world or you know, get fame or notoriety or something. It's a very introspective tale.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess we'll get to this when we talk about Shadow of the Colossus, but there is very much a sort of interweaving story between all of Team Ico's... I mean, they're two games or what have you.
Yeah.
But you do get the sense that, yeah, like you're saying, it's a very personal story, but it's a personal one that connects into a sort of larger narrative about, you know, what people do in sort of tough times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we've said a lot of, you know, deservedly so, a lot of great things about the game, but I must live up to my curmudgeonly reputation.
Don't speak ill of the dead, Scott. The game is great. It's near perfect.
Was there anything that you... I remember it also, you know, the game's great and beautiful, and I think it's a really important game, but I also find myself getting frustrated at some points. Do you have any frustrations with it?
Why don't you share me your frustrations first, and then we'll see if I can think of anything.
Okay. So, one of the things is, I think this is a stylistic problem. The controls are kind of loosey-goosey, so it's not clear exactly... There's some weird depth perception issues.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes it's hard to tell, like, where you're going to jump and how high things are and things like that.
That's definitely the case, yeah. Especially when the camera is really high up or gives you a sort of stark vantage point.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene comes to mind when, after you fall into sort of the subterranean area,
mm-hmm.
And you're climbing on, like, chains and moving platforms, and there's, like, water underneath. And the camera is always positioned in such a way that if you mess up, you'll just fall and have to do it all over again.
Yeah.
So you really sort of have to basically learning where you are in that environment without much help from the camera at all. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, that's a complaint.
From a historical perspective, it's an interesting middle ground because it's before the time... Like, I feel like Uncharted is an example of how 3D platforming has evolved to a point where it's about finding the place to jump. It's not necessarily about making the jump itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but Ico is still in a middle ground where it's like three-dimensional, very cinematic, but those camera angles are not necessarily conducive to the most precise action. And yet the precise action of a 2D platformer is still expected of the player.
Right.
So it's a strange transitional period to look at, especially now that we've seen things like Assassin's Creed.
It's like the platformer
Creed
missing link.
It is. It's weird. Like, you know, you play Assassin's Creed and you just don't have those types of problems anymore because they've kind of they've made a choice to streamline things so that it's more about deciding where to jump, not trying to execute the jump from a skill level.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned Uncharted because the camera angles are definitely more helpful in Uncharted, but it is still a sort of minimalist HUD, for example,
right,
in the way that Ico is. So I do feel like they are in the same sort of platforming family. But you're right, and I do think that it's sort of necessary in Ico to accomplish what they did with the camera angles.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's just something that I'm not sure if that would fly in this day and age.
Yeah.
It just seems like it's of its time.
Yeah. I mean, another outcome of being so very minimalistic is there are times when I'm not quite, even now, and I've played the game many times, even now, there are times when I'm not quite sure what I need to do next.
Right. And the game never, you know, there's no breadcrumbs or anything. The game's just like, all right.
Yeah.
It's, you know, there's no tutorial even. That you just wake up and you just have to figure out what the buttons do.
Yeah.
I have one more complaint, and this is an interesting one because it has to do with remastering and so forth.
Okay.
So this remastering is of the PAL, you know, European edition of the game.
Yeah.
And
there's some changes.
There is especially in particular, there is a puzzle that involves it's kind of like a pump and it's kind of like a catapult.
That's so funny. I wrote this down as well. I got stuck on that fucking puzzle because I was like, I don't remember this ever being here.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's one puzzle and there's this platform that flings you upwards into the sky and you can use its momentum to augment your jumping height.
That's right.
So it's a pretty basic you know, I mean, we've been doing that since the 80s, basically. We've been using trampolines and platformers since the 80s. So, like, it's a pretty basic concept. Just the timing of it is so punishing.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I wonder why they got rid of that in the American version.
I can tell you exactly why they got rid of it in the American version.
Why? Why?
Because it's junk.
Yeah, but that's exactly right. And it's so funny because the American version, you just climb a different pipe and it's easy peasy, yeah. Right? And in this scene, I was faced with that puzzle thinking, this is not how I remember this scene taking place.
Yeah.
And again, the camera angle makes it so that it's not entirely clear that I can use that. Mm-hmm. And even when you do use it, right, it'll knock you up a little bit. And I was kept thinking, well, it's not knocking me up high enough. This must be useless.
Yeah.
And then I spent like 15 minutes like exploring the rest of the castle, trying to think of some crazy way to progress.
Yeah, I mean, that whole sequence probably took me the better part of half an hour, 45 minutes, 15 of which was just trying to get the jump right, and like 20 or so minutes was just, I must be doing something wrong, let's go explore another room or something.
Yeah.
And it's a really weird decision. I admire that they kept it in, because I feel like the European version was always the more complete version, because there's various things about the ending that are also a bit different depending on how many times you play it through. But like that one puzzle stands out as the most unsightly blemish on the entire game.
I completely agree. Tell me a little bit though for a second. What else is different about the European version?
If you play it through again, you can have a second player play Yorta actively.
And that was only in the European version?
I believe it was only the European version.
Interesting.
Also, they de-scramble Yorta's speech. So
yeah, I was aware of that, but I've never seen it.
I also think there's, so if you beat it again, there's like a little kind of Easter egg at the end where you share a watermelon with Yorta, like on the beach, where you just like have a snack or something at the end. I'm not sure if that's in the North American and European versions, but I'm certain it's in the European version. I'll have to replay it now that we've finished it once to see if we have a little picnic at the beach afterwards.
I want to add, first off, it'd be interesting to play it two players. I have no idea what that would do to the experience. Probably not improve it much, but...
It might be intriguing to see how... Because, I mean, there are certain points where... It feels, and Yorta kind of has a mind of her own. Like, she wanders off, she inspects the environment, she just kind of zones out sometimes. So it'd be interesting to see how it would facilitate the puzzles if an active person was actually playing it.
You presume that I would help you out in any way. I would just be even worse.
Stop chasing the birds, God!
one thing I want to mention that it's kind of, I don't know if it, maybe it's not indicative of the quality of the game, but it struck me as kind of awesome for me on this playthrough, was it, really near that scene we were just talking about, or maybe not, maybe I'm confusing the area, but I accidentally hit a tree and a rock fell out of the tree.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, what the hell is this? I've never seen this before. And so I looked it up, and there was like a whole secret room where you can get like a secret sword or whatever, like a mace.
Yeah, I've never even gotten the mace. Like, I've looked at it, you know, I've looked at it online after I was done and everything, but, I mean, it's... There's just so many little touches that are not necessarily, you know, from a purely utilitarian perspective, they're not necessary for the game to function, but they are necessary for the game to do what it does.
Yeah, and the great thing is, it's not that the mace makes you overpowered and that there's many secret little hidden things. There's really only one.
Yeah.
That's the mace or the sort of lightsaber thing on your second playthrough, apparently.
Yeah.
You know, it's not existing there to make the game easier for you. It's existing there to make the world that much more rich, right? Mm-hmm. Like, who threw you this mace? Why is there a sort of secret weapon? They take the weapon away from you near the end of the game anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Once
and,
you fall,
and you
that's
don't
it.
Get... Yeah, once you fall, it's gone, and then it takes so long to get it in the first place. So, yeah, interesting.
You know, I think I probably fell for this trick the first time, and maybe even the second time I played it. But when you think you're gonna escape and you're frantically dragging Yorta, which is I had forgotten that she's drained, she's injured basically after she opens the gate onto your escape, and
that's
so
right.
If you run too fast, she'll stumble and and you're like pulling her along. But anyway, so the witch tries to bring the drawbridge up, and you and Ico and Yorta are separated. And at first, I thought that was just going to be a full cutscene, so I completely I completely forgot missed.
Forgot to jump.
Jump. Then I was like, what's going to happen here? And then I just saw Yorta get further and further away. And it's not like the game, like, the game doesn't fail you out immediately. Like, you have to watch. And I was, like, scrambling. Okay, maybe I can just jump over here and everything will be all right. Like, it, you know, you have this, like, 30 seconds or so of futility before it's game over and you have to try it again.
Yeah, I kind of, it's hilarious, but also that scene is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, again, you know, when you've been the one catching this person throughout the entire game and you have to put your faith in her for a moment to catch you, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, and all of a sudden you realize what this must have been like for her the entire time.
Yeah, it sort of reminded me of the Prince of Persia moment where Elika is gone.
Yeah. I think that latest Prince of or the 2008 Prince of Persia has quite a bit of quite a large debt to Ico.
Absolutely.
Well, is there anything else before we ride off into the blooming light sunset?
Well, I'm curious to know, when you were done with Ico, were you really excited to start Shadow of the Colossus?
Oh yeah, I forget if I did this or not, but the impulse was to just boot it right up.
Yeah, I booted it up right away.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's just, you get into that Team Eco mindset of how a world works and how progression works, and it's different. It's, like, slow, and it's more thoughtful, and you have to take more risks because they don't really tell you exactly what to do, but it's really compelling. But then again, I think Shadow of the Colossus is a lot longer game, so we'll have to give ourselves a little bit more time to work through it.
We will. We'll come back.
I guess in the meantime, if folks want to write in with their comments or suggestions, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And experiencepoints.net is the website. Come on down and bring your friends.
All right. Until next time. Take it easy.
Yep.